Hello, once again, welcome to the Gratuitous Pausing Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Greyhawk.
And I'm the long-haired blonde one that he keeps in a tower.
Thank you for joining us for episode 24 of our Disney Bracket, the final episode of round two. This week, we will be discussing 2005's Chicken Little, as well as 2010's Tangled.
This is a case we need to explain for people who are just tuning in how this happened. Our bracket is distributed based on box office success, not necessarily other qualities of the film, which is why Tangled is going up against Chicken Little, that film that you haven't seen, and if you have seen it, you don't remember seeing it.
Although, there are some interesting points of comparison. Both films do kind of boil down to their central tension being strained parental relationships. But anyway, let's go ahead and recap our points from our previous episodes on these films.
On Chicken Little, we talked about how it feels kind of rushed because this was our first time experimenting with 3D animation, and it kind of shows. We talked about how doing an alien invasion story was sort of inevitable based on what was popular at the time, and also how this kind of was the only place you can go with a Chicken Little adaption. We talked about how the protagonist's friends range from Fish Out of Water, who is wonderful. Abby is mostly great, but there's this weird thing where once Chicken Little kisses her, she just becomes useless. What's up with that? And then Runt is awful because there's so many fat jokes. Even though there are bits that shine, he's still an unfortunate character. We talked about how the world building is weird in many ways. How the film handles its popularity and bullying themes awkwardly, even if it does better with the father-son relationship or in toxic masculinity. And we talked about how Foxy Loxy gets brainwashed into being a Southern Belle, and it's really gross.
Meanwhile, in our episode on Tangled, we talked about how the film does a reasonably good job of unpacking all the stuff associated with abusive parenting between Mother Gothel and Rapunzel. We talked about how Maximus is the best Disney horse. Fight us. The dialogue in this film is incredibly snappy. It does a good job of not slowing down the film for comedy. However, there is some weirdness with the perceived age difference between Rapunzel and Eugene. The redemption of the snuggly duckling thugs was a little too fast, and the quarry sequence is a little bit too long. We talked about, in general, how great of a character Rapunzel is. She's incredibly proactive. She is very often saving herself or saving Eugene, as opposed to Eugene having to save her. The fact that they just nailed the characterization of Rapunzel when she first leaves the tower as someone who has been confined to that very small space for 18 years and has been living under this totalitarian parent, and some of the weird nuances of their personality that would manifest. There's also this quality to all of the songs involving Rapunzel that kind of fall back to this girl on an acoustic guitar in her bedroom sort of stylistic choice, and it works incredibly well for Rapunzel as a character. And overall, Tangled is a pretty silly film, but we felt that it did a good job of managing the serious moments versus the comedic moments pretty well. And the things that are important topics to unpack didn't feel diminished by the comedy elsewhere.
Going into this, I didn't really have a lot of great things to say about Chicken Little because I'd seen it once and that was enough for a lifetime. But I was kind of busy recently, so I had to watch it basically right before we recorded, and I was watching it at 1.10 speed, and that made it noticeably better. I mean, not just because there's less of it, but also it went faster and the jokes were more snappy. Adding more energy to it really helped. Yeah, so if you're ever like, oh, I should watch Chicken Little so I can know what they're talking about, watch it a little fast.
That also probably helped with some of the animation issues. Just to point out some highlight moments, at the very beginning of the film, the water tower rolling down the street and kind of destroying it, and you see this debris and rubble coming up, terribly, awfully animated.
It makes Katamari Damacy look like Uncharted 4.
The way the lighting affects the models is just off. Constantly. I can't exactly pinpoint how it's wrong, but to my brain, everything is wrong.
I can get into that a little bit, actually. When you create a 3D world, you have to have light sources. Some of them function like a light bulb or a spotlight, where they just emit light and they aren't set up to bounce. others are set up to have more complex calculations where it figures out how the light would bounce off of other things to illuminate what's around it, the way that real light works.
So effectively the difference between like hard and soft light.
Yeah, pretty much. And getting that down is hard. You can do it now pretty easily, but when Chicken Little was being made, it didn't have that luxury. If they have the settings just a little bit off, if they were using the wrong kinds of lights, or they were skimping by using a lot of the surround lights as opposed to hard lights to make things feel real, it would create a lot of weird lights and shadows that don't really reflect reality, but not in a way that's easy to pick up unless you know what you're looking at.
And it makes sense for those mistakes to be there. Again, this was a pretty rushed production. The animators working on this had been working in Maya for a year and a half tops when they started.
And that should bring me to another thing I noticed with Tangled. Last time we talked about Tangled and Frozen and how Tangled has really good lighting, but Frozen doesn't. Frozen has more of that soft light that surrounds everything, whereas Frozen uses more hard lights, but they don't feel like harsh. Part of that, I think, comes from the way that Tangled really likes to have two spaces in a shot, one that's illuminated, one that's not, and characters will move from illumination to dark, or from dark to light, or move between the lit up patches, so you have all this variety in the amount of light that's on a character in many shots. A lot of Baroque paintings will use this, where they'll have brighter light on an area that matters, whereas the rest will be darker.
And it makes sense for Tangled to do that. Light is a very important theme throughout that film. Rapunzel's powers come from the drop of sunlight that spawned the initial flower. The symbol of the kingdom of Corona is a sun. Her hair glows. The thing that she is trying to get towards are these floating lights. And you can also see a difference of light sources. The sources moving Rapunzel towards her goal are yellow or orange, whereas the ones that are moving Rapunzel away from her goal are these sickly greens.
As we learned from Little Mermaid and Black Cauldron and Sleeping Beauty, green glows are evil. Whereas yellow is a light that we see in the real world all the time, so it feels more healthy, more natural, and more safe. Whereas we don't really see green glows from things. If something's glowing green, something's wrong.
It also is heavily associated with the chthonic.
Yeah. I think the way that Tangled puts clear effort into putting light sources around so that it makes interesting shot composition makes it a really fun movie to look at.
One last animation nitpick that I want to throw towards Chicken Little. During the pennant game in Chicken Little, where Chicken Little is attempting to score the home run and everything, there's some slow-mo scenes that really highlight all of the issues that the animators were having with the models and the meshes. Everything looks really out of whack and distorted.
An animation thing I want to praise, though, during the flooding of the quarry, the water looked really good, but it doesn't look photorealistic. It looks like it's accurately representing water, but still in a cartoon world.
That water feels more viscous than real water does. It has more weight and volume behind it.
It also leads to that amazing scene where Eugene and Rapunzel are underwater and the hair is glowing and it just looks really cool. Did you have to read Casey at the Bat as a kid?
Yeah, I remember Casey at the Bat. Yeah, it was a short little story in one of the huge English tomes that we got year after year.
Right. If you don't know it, here's a bit of a clip.
There was ease in Casey's manner as he stepped into his place. There was pride in Casey's bearing, and a smile lit Casey's face. And when responding to the cheers, he lightly doffed his hat. No stranger to the crowd could doubt 'twas Casey at the Bat.
Since you have a primary focus on this kid playing baseball, who's a chicken, I was like, you know, I'm surprised they didn't make a KFC at the Bat joke. That could have fit in somewhere. That would have been fun. And as I was writing that, they announced that the opponents in this game are the Taters from Spudville, which is a pun on Mudville, from whence Casey comes. And I was like, wow, they actually went there, and that's a deep cut. I had a tiny, tiny bit of impressedness for Chicken Little.
Chicken Little, in some ways, is a very interesting time capsule film. It is very much a product of its time. It feels incredibly dated now. But I think that in the nearly 15 years since that movie's release, I think it feels very odd to have baseball as this sort of moment of triumph. I just don't feel that baseball is nearly as ubiquitous and part of the cultural zeitgeist that it used to be. If this film were made today, I think it would most likely be basketball or football.
Or lacrosse, you know.
Not everything's Teen Wolf, Jackson.
But I could have been watching Teen Wolf instead of watching Chicken Little, you see.
I can't disagree with that.
Yeah. Chicken Little is a very Midwest type narrative. It's got, you know, the corn and this, you know, small town rural America. And I think we associate baseball with being this kind of wholesome Midwestern thing, whereas basketball and football are more, I guess, modern and urban. Not that there aren't football players in the Midwest or anything like that. Like, obviously, we have the Colts? The Colts?
Yes.
We have the Colts. I think football doesn't feel as, like, wholesome and yokely as...
Also, football is much more associated with the South than it is the Midwest. Mm. Like, Texas, Alabama, Mississippi.
And I mean, maybe it's easier to represent visually because in football you have everybody running around at the same time in relatively similar spaces. Whereas with baseball, you have people in specific parts of the field, and that means less characters to animate, and that means less people on screen at the same time, which is easier to render.
It's a very valid point. Like, it's not just the baseball that makes this film feel dated. The music that they use, they're...
Oh, gods.
You've got Bare Naked Ladies playing as Chicken Little is attempting to get to school. You've got REM playing during the alien invasion. Spice Girls during the karaoke scene. This is very much just grabbing all the late 90s, early 2000s nostalgia that it can and packing it in.
Some of that is aged better than others. The Spice Girls are immortal, but the Bare Naked Ladies definitely feel like a part of their time.
There's also, to a certain extent, the voice actors. You have Zach Braff and Steve Zahn. Incredibly popular during the early to mid-2000s, but aren't getting lots of work nowadays.
Meanwhile, you got Wallace Shawn in a cameo as the principal.
Ever since that sky falling incident, he's been nothing but trouble.
And I didn't realize that the first time, but it brought warmth to my heart.
We also have Patrick Stewart in this film, too.
Do we?
As the sheep teacher.
Wow.
Mr. Woolsworth.
Class, turn to page 62 and translate each word in mutton.
Wow.
And then Don Knotts as Turkey Larky, the mayor.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. Oh, God. Okay, so the mayor. There's a scene where they're buying a carbonated beverage from a vending machine, and you see the dollar bill pretty closely, and they're like, okay, let's see, like, what animal is George Washington in this world? So I paused it. It's just the mayor from this town. It's Bank of Okie Oaks. This town they live in has their own currency. They're not part of America. They're their own separate thing.
Now that makes me think that that town might be a company town and they're not paid in real money, but scrit.
Oh, yeah, I can see that.
While we're kind of in, like, little weird minutiae, on this watch through, I noticed at the beginning of the film that Rapunzel's mobile, as she's in her royal crib, actually has a chameleon on it for some reason. I'm like, oh, hey, that's a neat little call out to Pascal and why she would have a pet chameleon. But if you go back and freeze frame, you can see some other things there. You see a duckling, a cupid, and a white horse. There's at least one other icon on the mobile, but it's incredibly difficult to make out. It's kind of bluish. You have the duckling that comes back with the snuggly duckling. Maximus is obviously a white horse. And then you have the old drunk guy who is constantly dressed in Cupid garb.
Suggesting that the most important four things in this story are Maximus the horse, Pascal the Chamonix, the old drunk guy, and the snuggly duckling where she meets the old drunk guy, which raises additional questions.
I think it's a nice little foreshadowing twist that these are the things that are going to help Rapunzel reunite with her family later. But it might also be that she gravitates towards these things due to that really early imprinting of those memories, as we can kind of see in the scene where Rapunzel has been taken back to the tower by Mother Gothel, and then everything clicks, and she sees in her paintings the royal crest of Corona all throughout her artworks, and all these memories come rushing back.
Maybe I'm reading a little too much into this, but I think having one of her core memories be a mobile is interesting because a mobile is out of reach of the child. It makes the child want to reach beyond their limits, which Rapunzel has the same thing. So there was kind of no way for Gothel to not have this rebellious exploratory child.
There's also some other interesting little things. There's somewhat of a question why the crown that Eugene steals is kind of out in the open and so heavily guarded. So as we're discussing this, we kind of came to the conclusion that due to the festival, the crown for the princess is probably on display, and all the extra security and guards around it are due to the parents, barring everything we know what's going outside the story, kind of false hope that their daughter is going to return. I mean, it proves out that, yeah, they were completely legit for waiting around 18 years for their daughter to come home, but most people are not so lucky when they have a missing child.
And the idea of the parents being a little obsessive is totally understandable. That's a totally valid reaction to losing a child like that. Makes them a little bit more tragic, a little more complicated, and adds some layers to the story that we see then reflected in Rapunzel, weirdly enough. So at the end of the film, Eugene is dead. Her hair is broken. She can't do anything, but she's still trying. She's still trying a song, and she cries, and it works. So you have this idea of it not giving up on your dreams actually sometimes works out if you, I guess, wait long enough or keep trying hard enough, which is kind of cool. Speaking of nuanced characters, let's talk about Mother Gothel a little bit. Something we realized was that she doesn't seem to have much of a plan. She has this girl in a tower who is clearly growing up and getting more and more curious, but she doesn't seem to have any plan to separate the magic from the hair and the girl. And she didn't think to cultivate this flower. She has to keep coming back to it. She didn't even uproot and move the flower somewhere closer to her where she could keep an eye on it. It's odd that she doesn't have this kind of forward-thinking aspect to her. But then again, if she's immortal, she doesn't have to. She can just wait it out.
Although, if you think about it hard enough, you do get to the conundrum. Is Rapunzel also immortal due to the hair? Because she's obviously getting older. There's kind of the, well, she hasn't reached full maturity yet. But is she going to continue aging past that? Can she keep herself eternally youthful with the hair? And if she can't, A, when is she going to figure out that Mother Gothel's not aging and she is? Or B, what's Mother Gothel gonna do when Rapunzel in eventuality dies? For someone who is canonically hundreds of years old, she is not a long-term planner.
We talked about how it's weird that she isn't a witch when she is in the original story, and making her this kind of ambiguously magical being without necessarily any unique traits beyond the immortality she's getting from this flower and from Rapunzel makes her seem a little bit more desperate. If she'd had more tricks up her sleeve, it might have been weirder for her to have to work through all these proxies and have to scheme as much as she does. And I think her scheming makes her interesting.
If she had her own power, she wouldn't have had to use all these abuse and manipulation tactics to keep Rapunzel in line, which is the entire conflict of the movie and what Rapunzel works through. So if she had those powers, I'm not quite sure we would have gotten that really interesting narrative. Honestly, for both of these films, the parental relationships are probably the highlight. Although in Chicken Little, it feels like a much smaller portion of the plot, unfortunately.
I think it's still a big part of the plot, but a lot of the parental stuff is tied up in other aspects, like Chicken Little's attempts to prove himself and his relationship with the town being also about his relationship with his father and that kind of stuff.
A lot of times it felt like the film just didn't know what it wanted its central conflict to be, and it kept jumping between Chicken Little's issues with the town, Chicken Little's issues with his father, or all the alien stuff. It's really interesting the ways that the poor parenting differs between the two films. Mother Gothel's bad parenting is very active and deliberate, whereas on the other hand, Buck, his poor parenting is much more passive, and he's trying his best. He just doesn't really know what he's doing.
And while I think that Tangled has a better parent-child dynamic thing going on overall, I do appreciate that Chicken Little gives us characters learning and growing and becoming better about their relationship. And as, you know, father-son, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. It is nice to see that that relationship gets repaired as opposed to severed. Not that it was not a good decision to sever the relationship with Gothel and Tangled. Sometimes it's the obvious best option.
Yeah. Sometimes you have to cut people out of your life or drop them out of a tower and let them turn to dust on the way down. I'm intrigued by the stylistic choice of having Rapunzel's actual parents not speak at all. And I think it'd be a really cool thing, a cool just like unique style quirk if there weren't that running problem of Disney parents being either absent or dead, and especially Disney moms being absent or dead, and that this is another Disney mom who gets super sidelined by that.
In a vacuum, I think that's an interesting stylistic choice, like you said. But in the context of the Disney canon, it's par for the course and it feels shitty, especially since this is a reunion that has been in the works for 18 years and that both sides have really, really wanted. Rapunzel not necessarily knowing that the lights equal parents, but, you know.
Something she definitely needed. She needed, you know, to have parents who really loved her.
Mm-hmm.
And her parents really needed to have their kid back, and they didn't have any more. And I'm a little sad we don't have, like, hey, these are your siblings. That could have been a cool narrative thing, but there wouldn't have been time for it. But I don't know, maybe that's part of this TV series.
It definitely does feel weird that a king and a queen wouldn't try for another heir, but that might honestly also just speak to how heartbroken they were to have their child taken from them, and they, I don't know, maybe were afraid that it would happen again were they to have another child.
That's true. And the Queen Mother did have a very difficult pregnancy, so I could see how they might be afraid of, you know, losing her too.
Mm.
Kings and queens in Disney have a really hard time having kids. It's like the universe doesn't want them to exist. One more thing with the king and queen. At the end of the film, Eugene talks about how he, you know, goes by Eugene and not Flynn, and he stops thieving, but he marries Rapunzel, and she's a monarch, or, you know, a future monarch, and monarchies inherently steal from the peasantry they subjugate, so really, he's thieving by proxy, just not by direct action. It's very frustrating.
Flynn also is readily willing to steal from his accomplices, so he's definitely not, like, on the 100% up and up.
Yeah.
So while we're talking about Flynn slash Eugene, can we just talk about how he probably has the most realistic reaction to learning that there is magic about in all of Disney?
He's very stressed out by that.
Her hair glows.
We're alive. We're alive.
I didn't see that coming.
Eugene?
The hair actually glows.
Like, we have lots of characters throughout Disney films who live relatively mundane lives until their films happen and they're caught up in all of this magic and wonder.
Aladdin finds himself in the crosshairs of a sorcerer. Cinderella finds that she has a fairy godmother. Jim Hawkins is really good at Rubik's Cube, so he can open portals to treasure planets.
Hercules finding out that he's the son of a god.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to be fair, he always kind of had, you know, super strength, so.
Is there anybody who just, well, I guess Anna and Elsa grow up, well, Elsa grows up having magic, but I think she's the only one who's really in a magical world from the outset and knows about it.
And all of these characters get exposed to these weird, out-of-the-ordinary things, and they just kind of roll with it. But Eugene, he has a, like, existential crisis. He has to completely readjust his worldview and how he thinks everything works.
Please don't freak out.
I'm not freaking out. Are you freaking out? No, I'm just very interested in your hair and the magical qualities that it possesses. How long has it been doing that exactly?
While, you know, having his hand patched up by this girl who just saved him from drowning in a cave.
And he's encountering a Shaman Leon, which he may never have encountered before. He has a fencing match, so to speak, with a horse.
You should know that this is the strangest thing I've ever done!
He's having a very unusual day, and I appreciate that he does, like, spend, you know, time stressing out about it. But on the flip side, when he sees Rapunzel having the really real normal human thing of trying to deprogram herself from her mother's gaslighting.
That's why mother never let me. That's why I never left and.
You never left that tower.
He understands what that is, and he gives her that space to work through it. Although, we do have another character who freaks out about finding out that they're in a genre movie, Chicken Little and Friends. They spend a good scene or two going, oh my god, it's an alien thing. Oh my god, it's from space. And, like, they have a good range of reactions to this. You got Chicken Little, who's
wants to deny everything because, with the exception of the sky falling on him again, his life is going up.
Mm-hmm. And Runt, who is reasonably terrified of these alien beings. And then on the flip side, Fish Out of the Water, who's like, ooh, a spaceship, let's jump in that.
To be fair, that's kind of their respective reactions to everything. Runt is terrified of pretty much everything and everyone. And Fish is like, ooh, that's neat, I'm gonna play with that. To round things off, we have Abby, who's like, no, you need to talk to your dad about this.
Another way that the film manages to bring the father-son conflict into other scenes where it isn't directly present.
I still kind of feel that that film's all over the place, though.
Oh, it definitely is. It's trying, but it's got too much happening.
There's also the fact that it has this really bad habit of dissolving all the emotional tension as soon as it happens.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, hey, we just had a real serious moment. Here's a fart joke.
And it doesn't really balance things that well. Like, the sequence of finding out the aliens are real, getting onto the ship, getting off the ship while being chased, and then being chased through the cornfields goes on, and there's so much time that must have been pretty hard to animate because you've got all these moving parts, and you've got all this corn, you've got these alien devices, and some of that time could have been spent developing characters more thoroughly and making them more real, and you wouldn't have these kind of boring and fatphobic action scenes. You could have had, like, real character moments. Like, I love Fish Out of Water, but I want to know why Fish Out of Water hangs out with these people when he's too cool for them. While many things in Chicken Little are kind of scattered, I do appreciate that they did have some good animal puns. You gotta have good animal puns in a talking animal movie. One of the news reporters is a dog, and his microphone reads K9. In the background, you see a stork running into the windows of a shop, and the shopkeeper opens it, and it's a bull. And behind him, you can see a lot of china. Cute little things like that. They're nice.
In the same vein, a really nice little thing that I noticed in Rapunzel is during Rapunzel's confrontation with Mother Gothel in the tower, you know, there's some physical altercation, and the mirror that has been used in a couple important scenes, like during Mother Gothel's introduction and the Mother Knows Best song, along with when Rapunzel kidnapped Flynn Rider, it gets shattered during that conflict, kind of as a physical representation of the illusion of Mother Gothel's relationship with Rapunzel. And that now that everything's out in the open, Rapunzel knows, no, Gothel doesn't care about me, she just cares about my magic.
Did I mumble, Mother?
I think it's probably pretty clear what we're moving on this week.
Yeah, it's gonna be Tangled. I don't think there was a lot of doubt in most listeners' minds. We were not excited for episode 15 of round one, but there was a clear winner, so Chicken Little moved on. But it can't really hold a candle to most other films on the bracket, and so it is being stopped here.
I will say, though, there is some good stuff there, and it's not unwatchable. If you just want to hit that Disney completionist thing, or you, I don't know, have complicated feelings about your dad and want something that will give you the motivation to talk to him and realize it'll help avert an alien invasion, cool, this is your movie.
I think it might be worth a watch if you have never seen it or it has been quite a long time, but this is probably not a Disney staple that you're gonna grab out once a year or even once every 3 years.
Then again, it's not a bad movie to just, like, have some friends over, have some beers, kind of make fun of it. There's stuff you can work with in there.
Yeah, especially if you were growing up during the early 2000s, there's a lot of things that you can pick at or, you know, fondly reminisce about.
Mm.
But with that, that concludes round two of our bracket. Which,
ooh,
we are getting relatively close. We only have about 7 more episodes. We're going to be moving into round 3 next week, where we will be discussing Moana as well as Hunchback of Notre Dame.
So now we're getting to the things that I've, like, learned that I really love, and it's going to, like, break my heart more and more each time. And I'm not excited about that.
I mean, we're going up in this bracket, and these decisions are going to get harder and harder. I mean, we're not adverse to hard decisions. We always have the audience to fall back on if we need to.
That's true. You're all voting on the next one. We'll just, like, talk about the animation for 2 hours and then see what you say. That's it. It's we're free now. No more decisions from here on out.
That's not quite how it works, Jackson.
Oh. But I'm a podcast judge now. I can make laws. Thanks for joining us. Smash that share button, like that comment button, and join us next week.
Once again, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and of course, right here on Podbean. Once again, this has been the Gratuitous Pausing Podcast. We hope you tune in next week.